Right. So I wanted to get all properly set up with the proper speakers and all that, but I forgot to do that. I get caught up in the social time and forget that I have something that I want to prepare. So hopefully I will be able to pull this off. Let's see. I do have sharing capability, and so we're going to listen to a song first. And it's only 4 minutes long. It's be familiar with for many of you. And then we'll become clear why we have listened to it. So, oh, let's see. I mean, I probably didn't share. I have to share like computer sound and stuff. So hold on. Share options, share sound, optimize for video sharing. Okay.
Are we done recording? We are recording.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that?
I usually see it on top. I just wanted to make
Oh,
sure that
he caught it.
He did. Okay. So hopefully no ridiculous ads will come on, but well, we'll see.
To every purpose under heaven, a time to be.
So I thought that would be a little more fun than me just reading Ecclesiastes 3. So that is, of course, from the Bible. Really beautiful. So I've been hearing from many people and experiencing myself cognitive dissonance, which is a state of mental discomfort that occurs when we hold beliefs or opinions that are inconsistent or that conflict with an aspect of our behavior. And that definition makes it sound like a character defect. But I think myself that some cognitive dissonance is an inevitable part of being human. We are aware of how our neighbor, our friend, or a family member is suffering. And yet we experience joy and ease on a daily basis. We may walk by those who lack even a home to go to, but we enjoy our blessings and even arrange our lives to increase our pleasures. Our family members need our presence and company, but we go away for silent retreat. We know there are many things we should attend to, but we take time to restore our souls by quietly gardening or playing music or reading or sitting in zazen. We sincerely mean every word of our bodhisattva vow. Vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. And yet, we sit zazen. The instructions for that: put aside all involvements and suspend all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. We aspire, I presume, to compassion, generosity, responsibility. Our bodhisattva vows. So, how can we relax? How can we really sit zazen or go on retreat or enjoy our lives without a pervasive sense of cognitive dissonance, without a sense of guilt or sadness, shame, discomfort, unease, or at the very least, just dividedness, a sense of, being present when we're not, we ourselves are not in suffering. Maybe feeling joy and ease and the awareness of other things that are going on, even other things that we are partially culpable for, and or at the very least, our silence or inaction could be seen as allowing things like injustice to continue. So sometimes we just feel the need to turn away from the suffering because of this, because it's just, what are you supposed to do with it? So today I was going to talk about two ways to relieve that, some of that sense of dissonance or dividedness. And the first one is, of course, because this is Buddhist practice, is just to accept it, to recognize it and accept it for what it is. Now, 2,500 years ago in the Buddha's time, you would be aware of the suffering or potential threat in your village. Or maybe through the grapevine, the kind of kingdom you were part of, or, you know, whatever organization it was. I mean, even earlier than that, at one point, as a human being, the way we evolved, we would kind of know our tribe, right? That's about it. We would know who was suffering in our tribe. And there would still be instances, right? Where somebody's ill or somebody has suffered a loss or something, and then that's out of keeping with how they are feeling or what we feel we might should do for them. But then it keeps expanding. And now we are aware not just of the suffering of the people we know, but suffering all over the world. Suffering in the past, suffering that's likely to happen in the future. We not only witness what's immediately around us, we can see and hear suffering happening on the other side of the world. So obviously we can't relieve all of it. Even if, okay, I'm gonna give myself completely to my bodhisattva vow. I'm gonna free all beings. We know that that is just impossible. Even if we worked ourselves to exhaustion and died, we would not have ended all of it. So obviously we need to take care of our lives and appreciate our gifts. Interestingly, Ecclesiastes in the Bible continues, "What does the worker gain from his struggles? I have seen the task that God has given people to keep them occupied. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also put eternity in their hearts. But man cannot discover the work God has done from the beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and enjoy the good life. It is also the gift of God whenever anyone eats, drinks, and enjoys all his efforts." So to some extent, just recognizing that this is what we are feeling, that we are at the moment because of the need to rest or enjoy our lives or take care of our responsibilities, we are not in an obvious way enacting our bodhisattva vow, even though we are aware of suffering. And that is going to cause some kind of dissonance in us. A second way to think about this or approach it is a time for everything. So some of our cognitive dissonance comes from imbalance in our lives. In other words, we're not allowing there to be a time for everything in its turn. In Buddhist terms, we aren't embracing impermanence, but trying to hold on to one activity when another one is called for. I think sometimes there is a resistance in our practice to really giving ourselves over to zazen or retreat, because it just seems so passive. There's so much going on in the world. There's so much injustice. There's so many things that can be done, whatever. Our lives, we should give ourselves creatively to our lives. So what are we doing just sitting there? But I like to think of it as, you know, sleep is really good for us, but we're not saying you should sleep all the time. You know, it's, there's a time for zazen and there's a time to get up and, you know, get busy. There's an occasion for everything, time for every activity under heaven. A time to sacrifice some of your comfort, some of your time for concrete bodhisattva service to other beings. Dogen says, foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. But this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. So I know everyone here feels deeply the truth of universal brotherhood and sisterhood. If anybody knows a better general gender-neutral way to say that, camaraderie. But that is, I don't know, brotherhood and sisterhood sounds so intimate and close, right? Like we are family. I don't know. Anyway, if you can think of it, kinship. Yeah. Feels deeply the truth of, you know, universal humanity connection. So that if you are living your life in a way, which for one reason or another is focused only on your own well-being, or perhaps that of your immediate family, at some level you will experience cognitive dissonance. It can be challenging, but finding something concrete to do can do wonders for relieving that cognitive dissonance. Like beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. And I have been all over the map with respect to how much of this I have in my life. I have gone for long periods, you know, after kind of burnout or I'm busy with other things where I'm not really doing what I would like to be doing, kind of out in the world. But when I find something that I can do, it is really just like it's like a weight or a worry or a sense of dukkha or pain is relieved. And like I've gotten so used to it, I don't even really know it's there. But then when I'm giving myself to something that I've picked my thing, I'm doing my best. It just feels like I'm part of a flow. And I don't worry as much. It's very sweet. But I mean, I'm helping to organize this big interfaith thing that's happening on Saturday. And so I'm like making banners. I'm going to Home Depot and getting PVC pipe for the, you know, to hold the banners up. I'm organizing who's going to be speaking. I'm, you know, doing all this stuff. So it's really busy. And then like that thing's going to happen. and then what? Right. But I hope to continue like an interfaith action network or something like that. But, you know, things kind of come and go. We don't always have something that we can give ourselves to in that way, but it is very interesting to try to find some way to feel like we are contributing. So there's a time for that. There's a time for really like, okay, let's do something concrete, you know, something that involves other people, getting out of your house, real interactions, you know, real activity in the world. And there is a time to recognize how your life, just as it is sufficient. As we say in our dedication with the chant on Sundays, any act of devotion, no matter how small, creates change in the world. So in the Bodhisattva Shishobo, the four embracing actions of a bodhisattva, which is where that Dogen's foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. But this is not so. That's from there. And he also says this: a child offered sand to Buddha and became King Ashoka in a later birth. They were not greedy for reward, but only shared what they could. To launch a boat or build a bridge is an act of giving. If you study giving closely, you see that to accept a body and to give up the body are both giving. Making a living and producing things can be nothing other than giving. To leave flowers to the wind, to leave birds to the season, are also acts of giving. So how's that for turning ideas of giving on their head? To accept a body and to give up the body. So it's not even limited to the productive things you do in your life that are beneficial in some way. So there's a time for that. And yet, if that's all we do, anything that I do can be seen as giving. There's going to be some dissonance with that, right? As beings need our response. They need our help. We're not really that helpful to them. They're saying, I'm extremely hungry right now. And you're like, I'm accepting my body. Okay. So there's a time, and our minds, I don't know why our minds, we want to have like one position, like this is what I'm going to do. And this is what I'm going to do all the time. And this is the right way. When sometimes things are right, sometimes something else is called for. A time for discerning what is beneficial from what is harmful, what is just from what is unjust, what is based in hatred and fear from what is based in love. And we have all kinds of aspects of our practice which are calling us to do this. If we're going to fulfill that bodhisattva vow and you know, benefit all beings, we have to think about what that means. What does it mean to benefit all beings? What does benefit look like? What does harm look like? Delusion. How in what ways are we deluding ourselves? In what ways do we get confused about what's helpful? We need to discern, and we may discern that others are seem to be operating from some delusion and causing harm when maybe they're not intending to, or maybe they are intending to. We have our precepts. We have the paramitas. We have the four Brahmaviharas of metta and compassion. So we have all kinds of things in our practice which are encouraging us to, they require discernment. They require deciding what is right and wrong. But we don't have to, take a position. Somebody was just asking me about this morning, so I'm just going to repeat what we were talking about. I like to think of the precept, do not be mean with dharma or wealth. Share understanding, give freely of self. So self is it's an interesting use of self here, where self is like, oh, well, there's not really any self, or we want to let go of self-attachment. And, you know, so what does self where does self figure in here? But it's like, you don't have anything to give that isn't related to self. I mean, that you are yourself. Any resource, any words, any actions, any stance, like, are coming from this self. So giving freely of self, to me, means not only, but one of the things it means is I may say, look, given my experience, and I've tried to make my vision as clear as possible, that looks to me like injustice, and I am going to do whatever I can to stand up against it, or whatever the situation is. That looks harmful, and I am, going to do something about it. And there's a way that can be my generosity, not a stand. I do not have to decide that everything else is wrong and I am right. I don't have to even divide it into right and wrong. I can just say no or yes. Like, this is my offering of self. And then it's it doesn't have to be divisive. It's not about vilifying the other side. It's not about having to win. It's also flexible, right? Because I'm making my best call here, but I may experience something. I may learn something that goes along that I may want to change my mind. So there's times for that discernment. And then there is a time for letting go of all concepts, all discrimination, just to see directly. Letting go of all of that effort to make sense of this world and decide what we should do. And, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one that can just find myself, driving down the road, find my mind just like, I don't think so. I think we should tax people more so that these roads are in better condition. And I'm going to create my whole view of the world so I know it's the right view and I can like kind of form an opinion about everything, right? I'm going to carry around these opinions so I'm ready. And it's exhausting, right? And usually kind of a preconceived notion isn't going to be that helpful when I do come to a decision point at some point anyway. So can we take time, right? There's a time for that discernment, and then there's a time for letting go and being in, the independent dimension. Everything just is as it is at this moment. There's no use in, an internal woe is me because the world ended up this way. Here it is. Can we be fully present for it? And that's something that we can learn to do, not just in Zazen or in retreat, but at any moment, we can just take a few breaths and just let go of all of that and just be. And I find if there is balance in our life, if we know that we are just quietly working in our garden, or we are just enjoying dance, we are just giving ourselves over to a simple restorative activity, and we know there will be a time that you will give some time to beneficial action. You will take some time to bearing witness to what's going on in the world. You know that you will incorporate that into your life at other times, then you can let go of it right now, right? But just enjoy it without that sense of like cognitive dissonance, because there's a time for everything. So I will open it up there and invite, obviously any kind of comments or questions, but also invite you to think about other kind of pairs of activities, that there's a time for this and another time for that. For example, there's a time for giving and giving, and then there's a time for self-care. There's a time for intimacy and opening our heart, and there's a time for boundaries. So, yeah, open it up and leave it there. If anybody in the cloud is not aware, down in the Zoom, there's a react button. And if you click that, there's a raise hand feature, which will put your hand up until I call on you. Rachel.
When I think of the precept of don't be mean of Dharma, give freely of self, it's hard sometimes because I always want to give something concretely, I guess, like I'm giving something physical away. So sometimes I have to remember it's also a listening ear, a shoulder to cry on. Sometimes it's sitting there listening in silence when someone's going through something. And sometimes it's just something that's not concrete. It's something that you sometimes don't even are, you're not even aware that you're doing until someone points out that you're a good listener or you're really kind or something like that. And then when I think about there's a time for things, I think that that's where the cognitive dissonance comes in sometimes, because you know there's a time for this, but is it the right time for this? Is this where I make my stand, or is this where I need to back off for a little bit because maybe this is not the right moment for it? But I think that in the end, we're just trying our best in a world that is tipsy topsy turvy. It's really, really just on its head. And I think we're all trying to find our ground at some point, and we're trying to figure out, is gravity even real at this point? That's how I feel sometimes.
Thank you. Leah.
You said pairs. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. You said pairs of things, and this is what I thought of as these two things that can coexist but seem a little tough to relate. Detachment and care. You can still let go, but you can also love deeply, really deeply. And that to me is that I'm working with that. I'm working with that. That boundary between the two is really tough to find, and it seems really fuzzy and really hard. And if anything, I tend to be on the, you know, love deeply side. You know, it's like, well, I'm going to be a bodhisattva, and I'm going to be a warrior for love, and I'm just going to love everything, you know, and it's just, and everybody until, yeah, you know, it's almost like a forceful kind of, I'm just going to love everything until it's right. And it's, well, but I mean, the word detachment, even I just look at detachment, and I go, but I can't be detached. That seems bad and wrong and everything like that. But I kind of know, like, I kind of know that there's, like you said, a time for both. So anyway.
Yeah, it makes me think of, I guess the way that I would phrase that is, you know, there's a time for human emotion and there's time for equanimity. You know, that there's that fourth Brahma Vihara, which is equanimity, which can sound like, you know, kind of cold, you know, unattached, yeah. Like I care, but I don't really care, you know, but I love really exploring that idea of equanimity as being just more spacious and able to contain so that we can receive the suffering of the world or our own suffering without being so agitated and upset by it. You know, if we are all like drawn into somebody's stuff, right? And we're like, oh my God, that's terrible. Oh my, you know, like, I mean, that's good in a way, but like, if they're really upset, they also could really use us to be more still and to kind of communicate that it's okay. But like, this the time for one, time for another, right? Because sometimes somebody just wants a hug, you know? Somebody just wants you to say, that sucks. Oh no, that's terrible. I'm so sad. As opposed to like, well, you know, how are you practicing with that? Thank you. Eva.
Thank you for this topic, Domio. I think people who work in education and healthcare are constantly having to deal with this tension. And I fall into this all the time because I'm a university teacher. And I feel like I give a lot. And my students say I give a lot. And one of the things I teach, actually, is stakeholder engagement. So I try to get my students involved in the real world. And to learn the sort of art and techniques of bringing people together, essentially. But what I find is, I sometimes need to pause and step back, and I do need that self-care. Because if I burn myself out and I don't take care of myself, then I can't actually guide my students appropriately. So that's something that I've had to learn over the years, because I've burnt myself out just giving and just giving and giving. And I think it's a constant flow in a sense to kind of learn how to transition between that giving, but then also giving to yourself. And I think they're almost like two sides of the same coin.
Just not excluding yourself from the equation. Jeff.
Thank you so much for your talk, Domio, and thank you for your tears. I really appreciate seeing you be human and see your feelings. I really rely on that. I don't know that I have, like, my thoughts are all a jumble right now, but I feel like part of the cognitive dissonance that I'm experiencing is just that the awareness that there are people who intend bad things. There are bad things. There are wrong things to do. And there's people who intend those wrong things, and they are unleashing them at scale on our society. And I feel like part of the cognitive dissonance that I feel and that I encounter with people is a desire to pretend it's not happening, and that a desire to kind of make believe that we are not really that. We are not really, say, a country that's being led by a fascist leader or by a fascist movement, and that it's not really that bad. And so I feel like part of bearing witness and embracing the cognitive dissonance is just being able to accept that, yeah, things are that bad. And like, I don't think that means that people are irredeemable. I just think it means that, like, being honest that there are people who intend bad things. And if we keep pretending that there's somehow that this is normal, we will end up in a far worse place. So anyway, that's what I'm struggling with, but I thank you so much for what you offered.
Thank you, Paulette.
For your talk, I actually read the Ecclesiastes at my grandmother's funeral because it was very, I don't know, Catholic. And so we couldn't share, like, I couldn't share a poem. So my only choices were to pick a passage from the Bible. And so I chose that one because I really liked it, even though I don't totally understand it. The part about time to kill, a time to hate, I'm like, I don't understand. But it reminds me of Bhagavad Gita because there's, Arjuna, who's struggling with, being a soldier. But anyway, I appreciate this talk, and I do feel like there's a certain acceptance level that I need to come to because I do tend to think that people are generally good. And I do think I still believe that, but kind of just what Jeff said, like I think there are people that have the intention to harm and the intention to hurt. And it's really difficult for me to believe that. I have a really hard time with that. But it's come up, I've come up against it so many times that it's a reality. And it's really disappointing. But anyway, I also have a jumble of thoughts. I'm not really sure what I wanted to say, but I just felt compelled to raise my hand. And I really appreciate everyone's thoughts on this topic.
I don't know if it would help anyone, but one of the most valuable things to me when I got into practice, when I got started learning about Buddhism, was it helped me with this kind of underlying fear and anxiety about people who do evil things. I was just like, I do not understand. It was like they were just like a black box. And I'm not talking about like kind of selfish things, kind of deluded things, right? Like just unequivocally. If you rape somebody, that it's no question there about that, whether that was a good thing or not. Like, and so it would just be like, I wanted to have this sense of common humanity, but then there was just this inability to feel that connection. And I don't know, I feel like the Buddhist teaching, I have been able to accept and verify for myself, is that everyone is just trying to avoid suffering and be happy. And if they do evil things, they do it out of delusion. I mean, even somebody who might be a sadist or whatever is like, in a weird, sad, twisted way, seeking their own relief and satisfaction, and not realizing in what way they are interdependent with other beings and that they cannot really get satisfaction that way. So, it's in, I don't know why it doesn't really help, right? It's like the people still are just the way they are. But for me, it helped me, it helped restore my sense of common humanity, even with even with people who do horrible, horrible things. I guess kind of like Thich Nhat Hanh's, classic poem, "Please call me by my true names," about just the greatest evil, and that can we still see that common humanity? And I prefer to see that, right? It's not really about, is that going to help the world, or is that going to like somehow, melt the heart of the other person? But just that's how I prefer to live. Ember.
Hi, thank you so much for your teaching and your words, and thanks everyone for contributing. And I'm a bit fatigued and a little bit anxious to speak, I'm noticing as well. So this may not come out that eloquently, but yeah, it was very moving to hear you talk. And a couple of things just occur to me. One, if I'm able to give like the way that Dogen is describing, maybe it seems, it seems very consistent with my limited understanding of the true nature of reality, because I don't have a permanent defined sense self, really, So to give seems really, yeah, beautifully consistent with that truth. And at the same time, like everything about the right time, like it really occurred to me that like I am responsible for what's here in my energy flow. I have an embodied experience, and I just thought it just struck me like I struggle with illness and fatigue and things, and like if only I could like actually be present with like what is here. Like I feel tired, so why don't I rest? Why don't I sleep, Because there's some script in my head about holding on to stuff or doing more, or yeah, And when I feel like I can help, sometimes I won't do that because I don't know, maybe I'm frightened or I've got used to watching Netflix, or something, So yeah, it just really struck me that if I could just be with the actual presence of what is here, I might find that flow, that rhythm of a time. Yeah.
Yeah. To accept a body and to give up the body are both giving. Zenko.
Hi, I want to express my gratitude to Paulette because I think she said, something that really strikes me. My head is a jumble, and I want to make sure that I have lots and lots of thoughts at the moment. And I want to thank you, Domio, for your teaching this morning. It was exceptional. I turn a lot to the Sandokai, that in moments when I kind of need a cornerstone to, hold myself up a little bit. I'm reminded of the line in the Sandokai: "Don't set up standards of your own." Because of course that's what I do. Oh, these roads need fixing. Let's set up a system where these roads are going to get fixed. Oh, let's do that. And here I am setting up standards of my own. It's a place my mind runs to when I want to try to control something that's obviously a bigger system and it's much more out of my control. And in the situation described in the poem about, or the moment, the excerpt from the Bible about accepting things as they are, and that there's all these different, seasons of experiences. Those, we're never in control of the when something happens. We're only in control of, how we respond to it. And so, I wanted to bring up the kind of the paired contrast of not setting up standards of your own and the turn, 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 which is, we seek to control what's well outside of our ability to control.
Well, that brings us to the end. Thank you. Oh, Ruthann.
Just repeating what everyone said. This is a very humble thing to hear for me, for sure, and I think for others. I thank you.
Thank you. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.